So it's Parsha Sra, page 998. Just to begin, we're dedicating today's shir to Chana Bat Monis, right? That's Rona's mother. That's Yortzeit tomorrow night, and Hashem should have an aliyah, and the whole family should be benched with long life and only good things and simchas and nachas. Apologies, I don't have a handout today, but just run through a quick overview of the Parsha. Parsha begins with the Torah telling us that when we go into Eretz Yisrael, there'll be the famous declaration of blessings and curses, which will take place on the two mountains of Har Grizim and Har Eval.
9 and 8,
yeah. The Torah also talks about when they go into the land of Israel to destroy places of idol worship, but not to demolish or destroy any part of the Beis HaMikdash. We're going to go into it a little bit longer, in more detail soon, but it talks about the whole idea of bringing sacrifices only in the Beis HaMikdash. We have the laws of Shechita in this week's parasha, actually, and all the things that go with it, like the prohibition of eating blood and so on and so forth. Kashrus is in this week's parasha. In other words, which meat and milk and kosher animals and kosher birds, kosher fish, and non-kosher ones. We have the paragraph to do with the prophets, good prophets and false prophets. We have also the law of Ir HaNidachas. Ir HaNidachas means the wayward city, the city that everyone or most of the people, inhabitants, served Avodah Zarah, in which case there's a very severe consequence, and that is that everyone has to be, the whole city has to be destroyed, actually. Although the Gemara does say that it never happened, because there's so many qualifications, so many criteria that are needed to create the status of this Ir HaNidachas that very hard to actually achieve. We have a prohibition called Loisis Goydudu, which we're going to have a look in a second. There's also the Maiser Sheni, the whole thing about the second tithe, that if it's too far to take Yerushalayim, can be redeemed and taken Yerushalayim. We have the Mitzvah of Tzedakah, that's big in this week's Parsha. Really the main sources of the concept of giving Tzedakah comes from this week's Parsha. Lots of different things. We have a repetition of the laws of the Jewish slave and the maidservant. And then we have a famous piece at the end to do with the Chagim, the festivals, which is always read on the last day of Yontif. Like it's the Kriya, the Torah reading of Shmini Atzeres, or the second day, the last day of Pesach, Shavuot, the second day of Shavuot, and so on. Okay. So what I want to do is, today, just have a look at one detail, one particular prohibition in the Torah, and share with you an idea from the Socher Tshuva, and then I'm going to do another part of the Parsha, also sharing with you an idea from the Socher Tshuva. Shemi Shmuel, a very famous commentary on Chumash, has some two beautiful thoughts this week's Parsha that I want to share with you. Okay. So the first one is, so it's actually not at the beginning of the Parsha, but it's the page 1010. The beginning of chapter 14, Perek Yudalet, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Right, you got it there? Torah says, Bonim atem l'Hashem alakeichem. You are children for Hashem, your God. In other words, he talks to the Jewish people and says, you are children of God. Loisis goydudu. Do not cut yourselves. In other words, do not self-mutilate. Or, v'loisasimu karcha bein aneichem, do not make a bald spot between your eyes. Lomeis, for a dead person. Why? Ki am kodosh atol Hashem alekecha, because you are a holy nation to Hashem, your God. U'becho bochar Hashem, and in you Hashem has chosen liyos lele am zgula, to be the special nation. Mikol ha'amin, from all the nations of the earth. Rashel peneho adoma, on the face of the earth. So the Torah here is making reference to an excessive expression of grief that was practiced in some cultures where someone would die, particularly if it was in a tragic circumstance where people would actually hurt themselves as an expression of their grief. They would injure themselves or pull out their hair and create bald spots between their eyes and so on and so forth. And the Torah has a very clear prohibition against doing that. Why? Because we're a holy nation and so on and so forth. What's the simple concept behind this. The Kli Yakar and other Mefarshim explain that we have, as I explained last night, actually at the shiur, we have in Torah a concept of grief. We have the mitzvah of expressing grief through sitting shiva and observing the laws of mourning when someone passes away. But we are warned in the Torah here, and in the Gemara it goes in much more greater detail, against excessive mourning. Why? Because excessive grief, in other words, grief in itself is a good thing because it's an expression of pain. The Torah designed a human being with emotions that need to be expressed and need to be properly managed. That's a healthy process to go through. In fact, the Gemara says you have to go through it. The Gemara says if someone doesn't go through the period of grief and the shiva, the laws of mourning, it's an achzar. That person is like a cruel person. It's an insensitive person. It was a person who doesn't have sensitivity or feelings. That's why they don't sort of feel that pain. They're in denial kind of thing. But on the other hand, excessive grief is a sign of extreme loss. Excessive grief demonstrates that you're mourning for something that is totally gone, that is completely lost. And in Yiddishkeit, that's a mistake, because our belief is that all is not lost. That notwithstanding the pain, notwithstanding the physical absence of the person who we grieve for, we believe that the neshama is still there, the eternity of the soul. The neshama, we believe, as the Mefarshim point out, has just transitioned from one place to another. And especially in the case of someone who's observed, done good things and mitzvahs and Torah mitzvahs and so on, those neshamas are safe and protected by Hashem himself. And therefore, while it is painful and while it is a concept of grief, nevertheless, excessive grief is an expression of lack of faith. And it's like sort of demonstrating that everything is lost. And that was the culture in among these cultures where they used to do things like that. They used to injure themselves to such an extent because, in other words, it was such a deep, excessive form of expression of grief to show that, like, that's it, that's all gone. And that we are not allowed to do in the Torah. Now, this pasuk which we learned, which says, Lo yisis goydudu, do not cut yourself, has another translation. Okay, and the Sochet Shoah points out this, and he raises an interesting question. We do find that sometimes the Chazal learn two mitzvahs or two concepts out of one pasuk, and they might be different. There might be different ideas, and they could be learned out of one pasuk which can be explained in two different ways. But the thinking is, and the Sochet Shoah points out this, and he says, even so, when that happens, one would imagine that there's some link between the two concepts. Otherwise, the Torah wouldn't structure it in such a way where you learn two completely different things out of the same word, out of the same pasuk, and they have no relationship between each other. Right? So therefore, if we learn two ideas, and there might be different ideas, but we learn two ideas from the same word or the same pasuk, one has to imagine that there's some link between these two ideas. So why do I say that? Because in this pasuk, there's two things which are learnt out, which seem completely unrelated, on the surface. One is the pasuk, simple meaning, and we just learned the mitzvah of the prohibition. It's one of the 613 prohibitions, one of the 613 mitzvahs, one of the 365 negative commandments, which is the warning against self-injury in the process of grief, right? But we find a different gemara, which learns a different prohibition out of this pasuk, and that is, Loisis goydudu, says the Gemara, loisasu agudois agudois. Do not make factions, do not make different groups. What does that mean? What's it referring to? The word tisgoydudu comes from the word aguda, which is a group, right? So the Torah is saying, do not make conflicting factions within one community. Now, in a separate discussion, really, nothing to do with what we're going to explain, but the truth is that it's a very, very interesting halacha, this. Because the application of this halacha is very fascinating in terms of halachic discussion. Its original meaning meant like this, that for example, in the times, let's say, where you had two ways of thought, two ways of thinking, for example, you had Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, right? And there were communities which used to follow the rulings of Beis Shammai, and there were communities used to follow the rulings of Beis Hillel. And let's say you have a particular town that follows Beis Hillel, right? This was before the machlokes was resolved and everyone paskas like Beis Hillel, for example, right? So you weren't allowed to, in one town, set up a second Beis Din following a different derech kind of thing, right? Different Beis Shammai as opposed to Beis Hillel. So you couldn't have one community. You got two Batei Din, one following Beis Shammai, one following Beis Hillel. That's considered a prohibition. It's disunity. It's considered division, and you're not allowed to do that. Or for example, if there's a town, you know, there's a famous machlokes in the Gemara where you can have poultry with milk. Now we pass, you're not allowed to announce and accept the halacha of everyone. But in the time of the Mishnah, it wasn't so simple. Rabbi Yossi paskin that you could, right? You could have a chicken and cheese sandwich, which we of course can't do today. But in his town, they used to do that. In other towns, the halacha was accepted. You couldn't do that. So no one would be able to set up a shul or a community within a community in a different place, which started to rule like Rabbi Yossi. You couldn't do that. That wasn't the accepted minag of the place or the accepted ruling of the place, because it creates disunity. Interestingly enough, there's a lot of discussion among contemporary poskim to actually understand the application of that today. And the reason for that is because today we don't have communities that way anymore, right? Especially post the war, right? Post the war, we don't have communities that are predominantly one community. You don't have shtetlach or towns that are one community. You know what I'm saying? You have in one town, you have Sfardim, Ashkenazim, Hasidim, not Hasidim, whatever, all everything, right? All Mish. So there are those that still that say that it is. We still have the application. For example, you just have to condense it. We are those that say that, for example, you have to keep the minhag of the shul, for example. Okay. So let's say if a shul has a particular minhag, then someone else can't do a different minhag, because that's the same. It would be extension of this prohibition of lois sis goydid. I once went into it actually at great length, because when we first started the shtibul, our community still till today is a big mix up of different people, different backgrounds. So someone once claimed that it's a problem. Like, I didn't particularly mind, but someone said there might be a halachic issue. There was a whole issue a number of years ago about putting on tefillin in Chol HaMoed. Right? So there's this thing about it's a big split, not split, it's two different distinct hashkafas where the mitzvah of tefillin. So the way it works like this, just to give you a bit of an example. So we know we don't put on tefillin on Shabbos and Yantav, right? Tefillin is a mitzvah for men to put on every weekday, but not Shabbos and Yantav. So the question is, what's the status of Chol HaMoed? Is Chol HaMoed considered a Yantav? Because on the one hand, it is a Yantav. It's part of Sukkot, it's part of Pesach. On the other hand, Chol HaMoed is not a Yantav in the technical sense. It's not a Yantav, you don't do work, right? So the question is, what's the idea? In other words, what do you consider a Yantav? What's the criteria of a Yantav? Is it a holy day, like part of Pesach or Sukkot? Or does there have to be an Isser Melacha? Does there have to be a prohibition against doing work for it to be called a Yantav? So Klal Yisrael is very split on this. The mainstream Ashkenazi derech is to put on tefillin a Chol HaMoed. Yes, to put on tefillin, right? The Vilna Gaon holds you don't put on tefillin a Chol HaMoed, which is why in Israel most communities don't put on Chol HaMoed, because in Israel many communities follow some of the customs of the Vilna Gaon for a whole historic reason. Sfardim don't put on tefillin a Chol HaMoed, and all Hasidim don't. Because Kabbalistically, the Zohar says it's a very bad thing to put on tefillin a Chol HaMoed, and we don't put on tefillin a Chol HaMoed, and so on and so forth. So now we live all together. People live all together with different customs. So the question is it okay to daven in a minyan and do what the minyan isn't doing, right? So for example, is it okay to daven in a minyan where the minyan is to put on tefillin and to daven the Chol HaMoed and not put on tefillin, or vice versa? Can you daven in a minyan which doesn't put on tefillin but you want to put on tefillin? Is it okay, right? So a number of years ago, there was a Rav here in town who made a whole thing about it, that no, it's lois sis goydid, it's an extension of this particular halacha, that you can't do that, you've got to follow the minhag of the shul. And he maintained that even though he was, actually, he didn't put on tefillin Chol HaMoed, but he was a Rav of the shul, did put on tefillin, he said everyone has to do whatever the whole shul does. So if the shul's minhag put on tefillin, everyone's got to put on tefillin, and the shul's not put on tefillin, no one can put on tefillin. So I started going into it, because actually I in Ashul Minig, not to put on tefillin, but I always have people here to put on tefillin, and never bothered me. So I looked into it extensively, and I came up with the conclusion that there are many, many, many paskim, although the Mishnah Berurah does say something like that, but many, many paskim hold that, particularly after the war, it's no longer a problem. After the war, since the communities are so mixed up, it's very hard to actually say that there's an established minag anywhere. That's the truth. Unless it's absolutely established, but because everyone is so mixed up, and everyone comes from a different background, we're all living together, putting on tefillin in a shul that doesn't put on tefillin or vice versa is not a display of disunity. And therefore, as long as the shul doesn't mind, it's fine. For the chazan to do it, that would be a different story. But for anyone to do it, it's not a problem. Anyway, so I found many, many pasukim that really say it's not an issue, so I wasn't worried about it. A similar concept we have here on Sukkot, for example. You know, there's a minhag to do nanuim, where you shake the lulav in different directions. So again, al pi halacha, you have to shake a lulav in six directions, up and down in the four directions. The order and which one you start with and how you do it, every community has different minhag. So everyone does something different. So as long as, right, so again. However, there is still this concept of, you know, in certain things which are very, very established, so we keep the minhag hamakom, we keep the minhag other place. Where does it all come from? It comes from this concept, loisis goydu, do not make groups within groups to create division. So Shemesh Mul says, it's very, very strange. We have two completely unrelated mitzvahs learned from the same pasuk. The one is about self-injury, the prohibition of self-injury in the face of grief. The other one is not making division among people in terms of halachic rulings within communities, not to cause disunity. So he says, if Chazal learned both mitzvahs from the same pasuk, there's got to be some connection. And he raises that question because superficially there doesn't seem to be any connection between these two halachas. So he says, no. He says, actually, there's a huge connection. And it goes into a beautiful idea. And he says the following. Why can't we injure ourselves in the expression of grief? So there's two things. He goes on two layers. First of all, he says, as the Zohar says, as many Mefarshim point out, that part of the emunah, part of the belief, when a person passes away, is that there is a neshama. And the neshama doesn't die. The neshama doesn't decompose. The neshama is eternal. And the neshama is with Hashem. Right? So therefore, that's part one that we explained before. The excessive grief is showing everything is lost. The truth, everything is not lost. The neshama is still there. However, how about if a person says, that's all fine, that's good, I understand, I believe in the neshama, but the self-injury, the expression of grief is not for the neshama. The expression of grief is for the body, and the body does on some level, is lost. Although we believe in Tchias HaMesim, and there's a certain eternity to do with the body as well, but at the end of the day, the body, when it's buried, when a person passes on, does disintegrate, does decompose, and there's a physical presence which is lost, which is no longer alive, which is no longer present, and with time will no longer exist in the form that it exists now. So therefore, since the expression of grief we're talking about here is not a spiritual thing, it's a physical thing. In other words, it's the grief which is being expressed for the body, and that's why it's done in a way where you harm the body, which is obviously symbolic of the loss of the body. So what's wrong? The person is not saying he doesn't believe in the soul, he's saying he's mourning the body. So he explains, yes, but that's true. But that type of excessive grief for the body demonstrates a mistaken value system in terms of what the body is. In other words, if the person is so devastated and the grief is pronounced to such an extent where the person injures themselves, why? Because of the loss of the body, what they're doing, what they're demonstrating is that the main part of the person is the body. In other words, that the fact that the neshama is still alive, the fact that the neshama is eternal, that's not enough for me. That's not enough to calm down the excessive grief. In other words, the excessive grief is still there because although I might believe there's a neshama, but I'm more worried about the body. So what you're doing is, in other words, what you're showing is that the body is more important than the soul, which we know not to be the case. We know the way a person exists, the way a Jew has to live, is that our neshama has to be the main focus of our life. And when we're alive, we have to view the body as the temple of the neshama, as the thing which houses the neshama. Correct? In other words, the whole importance of the body is that it's able to give the neshama expression. In other words, like this. Hashem wants the neshama to come down to this world. Hashem wants Torah mitzvahs to be fulfilled. Torah mitzvahs going to be fulfilled in the physical way. So the neshama has no other way of serving Hashem other than with the body. So the body serves as an important, a critical tool for the neshama to fulfill its mission, for the neshama to be expressed. Yeah, is that clear? So therefore, the way we live our life is that the neshama is the primary part of who we are, and we view the body as a toffel, as a secondary thing. The body is there to serve the soul is not there to serve the body. In other words, someone who who views the body as the primary part of our life, so they view the soul as being secondary. The soul is just there to keep our body alive. Persons die, the soul might exist, but the body's gone, so it's a terrible thing. However, we view the neshama to be the main thing of the person. The neshama is the primary force of the person. The body is just there to serve the soul. So therefore, when a person dies, as painful as it is, and as mandatory as the Torah makes it to express grief, but it cannot be that excessive grief, because that gives the impression that the body is the main thing. Whereas we understand once the neshama is the main thing, and the neshama is eternal, that lessens the expression of grief. Okay. So therefore, this whole mitzvah is not just about lack of belief in the neshama, it's also lack of belief in the importance of the neshama over the body. So it's about giving primacy to the neshama over the body.
That could be the reason why so many people managed to get out of the Holocaust, those religious people.
Any tragedy is like that, because as we said last week, Vashabram Leinechem, in other words, part of his understanding that there's something that, with all the devastation, something eternal that is still there, which is even, in a way, more important than the physical. Yeah. So just before I go on a very physical note, we've been having issues of parking with the neighbors. No one's parked in the third parking spot, are they? We only have four spots, and we're not allowed to park in the driveway, even if it's our line, if you know what I'm saying. So no one's parked in the third, you know what I'm talking about, number three from the wall? Okay, just want to make sure, please don't.
Huh? She was not very happy.
No. When, today?
Yeah, just
now. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, okay. Okay, so you know the email. Okay, good. Okay.
Just to break the mood.
I never had that problem.
No, you come by bus. Okay. Okay. Yeah, just all the sharing, please be mindful of it, that we just need to never use those third parking spots, even if you think you're in our line, because it just blocks getting out. Okay. Now, what's that going to do with the second mitzvah? So the second mitzvah we learn from this pasuk is loisis goydudu, not creating factions, not creating divisions. Where does this unity come from? So the Sacher Tshuva explains, and in fact it's explained in a bit more detail in Tanya. In fact, Rabbi Friend in the Chofetz Chaim video on Tisha B'Av mentioned this. You know, there's a concept we know of v'haftal re'echa kamoicha, we have to love another person like ourselves. Right, which is a very, very tall order. It's a hard thing to do, to have complete unity, to really love another person like ourselves. We have the famous story in the Gemara where someone came to Hillel, Shammai and to Hillel wanted to convert, and the condition was you teach me the entire Torah on one foot, and so on. So Shammai wasn't very impressed, but Hillel was okay with it, and Hillel sort of accepted him, and Hillel said to him, "What you don't like done to yourself, don't do to someone else. That's the entire Torah. The rest is commentary." And the famous question on that is, what do you mean? That might explain half of the Torah. It might explain that all the mitzvahs that have to do between man and man, right? But it doesn't explain all the mitzvahs between man and God. In other words, you could say that Avas Yisrael, loving another person like yourself, that is the basis for all the mitzvahs which have to do, social mitzvahs, have to do between people. Not stealing, not killing, not treating someone badly, not insulting, not getting angry. All these things, fine. They're all under the one fundamental mitzvah of Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamecha. But why would lighting Shabbos candles, or keeping Shabbos, or putting on tefillin, all these things, why would they come under, why would that be a commentary, so to speak, of the mitzvah of not mistreating another human being? And the answer is very simple, because he says, to serve Hashem, any form of serving Hashem, it requires a very, very fundamental belief. It requires a belief of nafsham ikir v'gufam tfeila, that the neshama is the main thing and the guf is secondary. When a person lives their life at their material pleasure, their bodily needs take precedence over their soul needs, then it's hard to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu properly. However, when we create a focus where the main part of who we are, our main identity, the real essence of who we are is our neshama over the body, then it becomes easy to keep all the mitzvahs. Now, it is that very perspective that brings to the concept of Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamoch, the concept of unity. Why? Because to be united means we're the same in essence. And people are not the same. Right? People are different. People have great differences between them. However, the differences come, so he explains that's the concept. The differences come between people. The differences come between people because of our superficial differences. In other words, the way we are different from one another is a body thing, not a soul thing. At the very essence of our neshama, we're actually one. Our neshamas all come from the same source. It's the neshama that unites us. It's the neshama that keeps us together. So when we focus on the neshama rather than the body, that takes away the ego, that takes away the focus on differences, that takes away the focus on superficial differences, and allows us to be united. When we focus on the body rather than the soul, then we highlight the ego, we highlight the differences, the superficial differences, and it's impossible to be really united. Right? So that's why Hillel told the convert, "Madalach sani, what you don't like, don't do to your friend." That's the basis of the whole Torah. But it's the basis of the entire Torah, including the spiritual mitzvahs. Why? Because if you can achieve that, that means you're placing focus on your neshama over your body. And once you place the focus on the neshama over the body, all the mitzvahs become easy. All right? Says the Sacher Tshuva, that's exactly what's happening here. There are two mitzvahs that are the same thing. The one mitzvah is don't. The one mitzvah is don't self-injure, don't self-mutilate out of expression of grief for a dead person. The other mitzvah is don't create disunity. Says the Sacher Tshuva, it's exactly the same mitzvah. Why does a person self-injure? Because as we explained before, it's lack of belief in the neshama, but not just lack of belief in the neshama. It could be the person does believe in the neshama, but it's making the body the main part of the person and not the neshama. And that's why when the body is lost, the expression of grief is excessive. But when a person is in the state of mind where the body is the main thing, and that brings to the excessive grief, that also brings to disunity. Because unity can only come when you make the neshama the main thing. So therefore, both those mitzvahs learned from the same pasuk are actually exactly the same mitzvah. It's all about making the neshama more important than the body. If you make the neshama more important than the body, then when a person dies, chas v'shalom, you won't express grief in an excessive way by self-injuring. And you also, when the neshama is more important than the body, it'll be easier to come to unity, and you won't transgress this mitzvah of making different groups within groups to create division and disunity. So therefore, they actually, although they seem completely different mitzvahs, but they actually are very, 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 very connected. So they're very beautiful explaining these two ideas that learn from the same mitzvah. Okay. Now, let's go back a little bit to the beginning of the parsha. Now, I want to just learn with you a little bit of the parsha. That's, you know, I don't know why, but it's like this with parshas. All parshas have certain parts that seem to be more learned than others. Right?
Popular.
That's right. So I'm going to take a part of the parsha that's not so well learned. Not so popular. Maybe because it's difficult to understand. I don't know. But it's worth learning to understand. It's a big chunk of the parsha. To understand what is actually going on here. Okay. So in okay, I'm just gonna have a look where we are. Give me 1 second. Okay, have a look on page 998, Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12. Let's learn a few psukim, and then I'm gonna explain to you what's going on here. Okay. So the pasuk starts the following, okay? Page 998, pasuk aleph, verse 1 of chapter 12. Says the Chumash, Eile hachukim v'amishpatim, these are the laws, asher tishmeru lasos, that you should guard, you should keep. Be'oretz, again, don't forget, Dvarim is all about preparing the Jews to go into the land of Israel. So these are the laws you should keep, be'oretz, in the land, asher nasan Hashem alakeh v'sech alakeh that Hashem is giving you, the rishta to inherit kol hayomim, asher atam chayim aladamah, for all the days you will be living on the earth. First thing you should do, says the Torah, you should destroy all the places asher avdu shom hagoyim, that the other nations served avodah zarah, idol worship there, asher atem yoshim osim asher lokeim, all that the land that you inherited, they used to serve idols there. Al horim aramim, on the tall mountains, valak voice, and on the hills, v'sachatz kol eitz ranon, and underneath all the leafy trees, because they used to serve idols very often under trees. Yep. When he touched them as Mizbuchai Seichem, you shall destroy their altars, Shibatim, break their monuments, Vashriam, Tistra from Aish, and their pagan worship trees, You should burn Upsila Elohim to Gadein. You should cut down the pagan images. The Ibadatem Meshmom, and you should just destroy their name and Amakokum from that place. However, he says, Loisasun Kain LaHashem Elokeichem. You shall not do that to Hashem your God. Right? Not do that to Hashem your God. Now, what does that mean, you shouldn't do it to Hashem your God? And then he's about to launch now into a whole thing, because this parasha is a little bit cryptic. That's what I'm trying to sort of just share with you the meaning of it. It starts off saying you should destroy all the idol worship places and so on and so forth. However, you shouldn't do this to our God. Now, on the surface, it means you shouldn't do what we just learned. And one way of learning is like that we're not allowed to destroy any part of the Beis HaMikdash, because we should destroy all the places of idol worship, but don't do that to Hashem your God. In other words, don't destroy or dismantle places of holiness. Okay. However, the Torah doesn't go on with that. The Torah goes to a whole other thing about eating meat and about bringing sacrifices to the Beis HaMikdash, and it seems to change course mid-paragraph. So let me explain to you what's going on in this part of the parasha, and then I'm going to take it a step further. I don't know if you know this, but when the Yidden were in the Midbar, when the Yidden were in the desert, when they traveled through the desert for 40 years, so they ate the man, right? The man fell from heaven. However, they did have meat, because they had lots of animals, right? There was one piece thing of meat, food that they actually did have. They had lots and lots of animals that they brought out with them in Mitzrayim, from Egypt, right? Now we know that after the story of Noach, going back way before Mitzrayim, after Noach came along, after the flood, Hashem permitted human beings to eat meat, right? We get the Torah, we get, in this parasha actually, we get told which animals are kosher, which animals aren't kosher, how we have to eat the animals, shechita, and so on and so forth. However, in the Midbar, in the desert, where most animals were domesticated animals, meaning most animals were sheep or cattle, they were allowed to eat meat, but they weren't allowed to eat what we call b'sar chulin. They weren't allowed to shecht an animal and eat it. Every animal, every time they ate meat, every time they wanted to eat meat in the Midbar, they had to bring it as a korban, they had to bring it as a sacrifice. Okay? Which means they would bring what's called a korban shlomim, they would take it to the Mishkan, bring what's called a korban shlomim, which is a peace offering, which means the korban shlomim is a korban where a little part of it goes on the altar, a little part of it goes to the kohanim, and the rest can be eaten by the owner, right? So it gives the private person who's bringing the korban meat to eat. That's the only way meat was permitted to eat in the korban, in the Beis HaMikdash. This didn't apply to wild animals like deer and these things, but it applied to all cattle and sheep. When they came to the Midbar, when they came to the Beis HaMikdash, right? So when they came to Eretz Yisrael, I mean, Hashem permitted eating meat, non-sacrificial meat. Okay, why? Simply because it was no longer practical, so to speak, on a simple level, to do that. People lived all over Eretz Yisrael. Don't forget, in the Midbar, they were all within a radius of a few miles, and they could bring it easily to the Mishkan. However, in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, they were spread out over the whole entire land, and it would be almost impossible to the whole time to bring. Anytime you wanted to eat meat, anytime you wanted a steak, a barbecue, you had to schlep it all the way to Yerushalayim to bring a korban. Right? That's not a practical thing. So Hashem permitted what we call basar chulin, to eat non-sacrificial meat. But then he gives us laws of shechita and so on and so forth. The problem is that people then, to transition to that frame of mind could be difficult. Because what happened is, and this changed depending what era they were in Israel, what happens then when a person doesn't want to eat regular meat, but they actually do want to bring a sacrifice? Right? They do want to bring a sacrifice. So what happens then? So we have a whole thing where the Torah says that you have to take it to the place where Hashem will choose to bring korbanos, right? Now, what happens if a person doesn't want to do that? Because what people might have made a mistake to think is that you're allowed to bring a korban in what we call a private altar. Don't forget, until the Torah was given, if you look at the time of Avraham Avinu, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Noach, right? They all brought sacrifices. What do they do when they want to bring a sacrifice to Hashem? They built an altar in their backyard, and they brought a korban, right? So it was very, very easy for the Yidden to come into Eretz Yisrael. They now know that they live far away from the Yerushalayim or the Beis HaMikdash or the Mishkan. They want to bring, they've been allowed to now, they've been permitted for them to eat regular meat. So they might think that if that's the case, it's okay to bring a korban that way too. Let's say I don't want to eat non-sacrificial meat. I'm in a mood of saying thanks to Hashem for something or whatever the case is. So what I want to do is I want to actually bring a korban. So I want to offer up a shlomim to Hashem. But I live in Tzvas, but hard to go to Yerushalayim. So I build an altar in my backyard, which is called a bomo. That's the expression used in the Chumash or in the Mishnah and the Gemara. I'll build a bomo in my backyard. And I'll bring a korban. All right. Says the Torah, you can't do that. You're allowed to eat non-sacrificial meat all over the place, but you're not allowed to eat. You can't bring a korban unless you take it to the place which Hashem has chosen. Okay? However, that's not so simple. And that's where it gets complicated. So I want to just give you a little bit of the rundown and then share with you an interesting idea. I'll show you how it works in the Pesukim. Hashem says that, you see, when the Yidden came into Eretz Yisrael, they went through different periods. Let me show what happened. In the Midbar, they had a Mishkan, correct? When they came to the land of Israel, so for the first 14 years, while they were conquering and dividing the land, they had a very, very small makeshift Mishkan. Yeah? Which they had in a place, Gilgal, I think it was, right? When they finally settled the land, they built a much bigger structure, still called a Mishkan, but it was a much more permanent structure, which they built in a place called Shiloh. They know where it is today, where that Mishkan was built. Why I say it was a more permanent structure is, unlike the Mishkan, the makeshift Mishkans, or unlike the desert Mishkan, it wasn't made out of wood, it was made out of stone, but didn't have a roof like the Beis HaMikdash. It had, the roof was still covered with the curtains like they did in the Mishkan time, but it was sort of more or less structure. Why I say it was pretty permanent, the Mishkan in Shiloh, it wasn't the ultimate destination for the Divine Presence, but it was a very long Mishkan. And the Eden had quite a long period of peace there, where they didn't conquer, they didn't fight wars. It was quite a long time. Well, how long was it? It was 369 years. Don't forget, even the Beis HaMikdash only stood for 410 years. The first one and the second one for 420 years. So this was almost as long as the Beis HaMikdash, right? Now, they couldn't build in Yerushalayim here because they hadn't conquered Yerushalayim. Because we know that when Yeshua came to the land of Israel, he conquered and divided the land for 14 years. Hashem was upset he took too long. But at the end, part of it didn't get done. And Yerushalayim was never captured. It was never captured from the Yevusim. It's only once David HaMelech came along, he finished the job, he fought the wars, and he conquered Yerushalayim. Right? And then it was ready to finally build the Beis HaMikdash there. Now, so the Mishkan Shiloh stood for 369 years, right? Then it was destroyed. Then it was a time of war, and it was destroyed. You know, on Rosh Hashanah, the first Rosh Hashanah, we read about the birth of Shmuel, the story of Chana, how she came to David. Where did she come to David? In Shiloh. That was the time of Eli HaKohen. Eli HaKohen was the Kohen Gadol at the time, and it all took place in Shiloh. That got destroyed. What happened after that? After that, they went back to a very temporary Mishkan in two different places, Noiv and Givon, which the total of the temporary Mishkan was in a place called, it was 52 years. All right? So that's the Cheshbon. They go 14 years temporary Mishkan, 369 permanent Mishkan, Shiloh, 52 years back to a makeshift Mishkan, and then the Beis HaMikdash gets built in Yerushalayim finally. Okay? So the way it works is, and we'll see how this all is in the Psukim, the way it works is like this. When they built a makeshift Mishkan for the first 14 years, they were allowed to bring, they had to bring in the Mishkan all the communal sacrifices. So for example, the daily sacrifices, the Korban Tamid, which is brought every day in the Mishkan, that could only be brought in the makeshift Mishkan. However, during that period, to have a private bomber, a private altar to bring other private korbanos was okay. You're allowed to do that. Right? In the first 14 years. However, as soon as they built the Mishkan Shiloh, that was much more of a permanent Mishkan. During the time of Mishkan Shiloh, ne'esru habomais, all private altars became prohibited, and all sacrifices, communal or individual, had to be brought in Mishkan Shiloh. Okay. However, Mishkan Shiloh was destroyed, and they now went back to a makeshift Mishkan in Noiv and Givon for 52 years. The heter, the permission to have a private altar, came back. So they only had to make communal sacrifices there, but all private korbanos could be built in a private altar just like it was in the time of Avraham Avinu, right? And then when they built the Beis HaMikdash, the prohibition against private altars was reinstated with a difference. The difference is that when it was in existence during the Mishkan of Shiloh, it was only while the Mishkan was there. When the Mishkan was destroyed, the heter, the permission to have a private altar came back. Once the Shechina arrived in Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash was built, private altars became prohibited forever. Even after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, which is why, even after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in Yerushalayim, there was no way anyone could ever make a private altar. Because that whole thing of making a private altar ceased to exist once the Beis HaMikdash was built in Yerushalayim. Clear? Where's it all hinted to in the Pesukim? Where do we see this? So let me show you. Okay. So have a look at the Pasuk Dalet, verse 4. Right? On page 1000. So the Pasuk says, Loi sasun kein l'Hashem olekeche. Don't do this to Hashem. In other words, what don't do to Hashem? Don't do to Hashem about bringing sacrifices on private altars. Ki'im ala mokem asher yivchar Hashem olekechem. You have to go to the place which Hashem will choose. Mikol shifteichem, from all your tribes, lasum eshmoi shom, to place his name there. L'shichnoi sidrushu uvasa shoma. You should seek out Hashem's presence and go there. Don't bring korbanos anywhere. You've got to go to the place where Hashem will choose. However, the Torah is very cryptic. It's not showing where, right? But just go some and says, Vaveisem shoma, you'll bring there ole seichem, your sacrifices, with zivcheichem, with maser seichem, with trumas yetchem, with nidreichem, all the things you'll bring there. Okay. Now, go to Pasuk 8. Pasuk says, Loi sasun kechol asher anachnu oisim poi hayoyim. Don't do what everyone is doing today, which is ishkol hayosher be'enov. Don't do, the Torah repeats, in other words, don't do what you want, kind of thing, right? Again, like as if not to bring don't bring a korban in a private altar, like we do today. In other words, what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying today in the desert, when we have a Mishkan, that's like a Mishkan is a very makeshift thing, that's like a private altar. When you get to Eretz Yisrael, don't do it. Why not? Now here comes the key pasuk. The reason is Ki loy vosem ad ata, because now you haven't yet arrived el hamenucha, to a place of rest, el hanachala, to a place of inheritance, asher Hashem oleikecha noisen lach, which Hashem your God is giving to you. In other words, because now we haven't yet arrived at a place of rest or inheritance, you can bring a korban in a private altar. But once you get to a place of rest and inheritance, you can't do that anymore. So Chazal tell us, what is this expression of rest and inheritance? Menucha and Nachala. So Menucha refers to the Mishkan of Shiloh. Okay? Nachala, inheritance, refers to the Beis HaMikdash. And very, very deliberately so. See, Menucha is a place of rest, which means when the Yidden came to Shiloh, there was rest, meaning Hashem chose a place that he would be for a while. He would rest his Shechina there. It would be much more of a permanent structure. However, it's not called inheritance. Inheritance is an eternal thing. Inheritance means it belongs to you forever. Right? So it was a place of rest, but it wasn't a place of inheritance. Which is why when Mishkan Shiloh was destroyed, the permission to build a boma came back. Which is very, very in line with something else that happened with Mishkan Shiloh. Mishkan Shiloh, although it was a great Mishkan, and Hashem's presence was there, and it's referred to in the Pasuk as Menucha, a place of rest, but yet we know that when Mishkan Shiloh was destroyed, the land upon which Mishkan Shiloh stood is no longer holy. I mean, we even know where it is today. There's no problem walking there or anything like that. Whereas the place where the Shekhinah came eventually when the Beis HaMikdash was built, that's called Nachla, that's inheritance. That's where the Mishkan was always meant to be. That's where Yaakov Avinu prayed and Yitzchak prayed and so on and so forth. That's the eternal home, the arriving of the home of the Shekhinah in the Beis HaMikdash. And that's considered inheritance and it's eternal. Even when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, the Shekhinah is still there. And that's why once the private altars became prohibited there, it remained forever that way. So that's Menucha and Nachalo, those two places, Shiloh. But if it's not Menucha or Nachalo, i.e. the 14 years before Shiloh and the 52 years between Shiloh and the Beis HaMikdash, even in Israel they were allowed to bring sacrifices on private altars, because only when they're at Menucha or Nachalo, that's where it becomes prohibited. Menucha is Shiloh, Nachalo, inheritance, is the Beis HaMikdash. Now, going back to the Shachar Tshuva, the Shachar Tshuva points out a very, very interesting thing. The greatness of Shiloh as opposed to the Mishkan, but not as great as the Beis HaMikdash. It explains the following. If you look at the materials, like what's holier? It seems that the holiest building of all at the end was the Beis HaMikdash, right? Shiloh was holier than the Mishkan, more permanent, but it wasn't as holy as the Beis HaMikdash. It says an interesting thing. We know that Hashem created a world with four things, four components to existence, right? We often talk about this. The doimim, the inanimate. Tzomeach, the things that grow. Chai, the animal kingdom. And medaber, and the human being. Human being, of course, is the highest form of existence. The lower form is the animal. The lower than that is vegetation. The lower form than that is inanimate. Yeah. When the Mishkan was built, in the desert, that is, there was, if you look at it, there was almost no materials out of inanimate, except for, well, some of the vessels were, because they were gold, but in the structure of the Mishkan, there was sockets at the bottom which were made out of silver, but that's it. The rest was either wood, right, so from tzomeach, from the vegetation, or even more than that, chai, from living animals, because a lot of the curtains were made out of animal skins. Right? When it came to the Mishkan, came to Shiloh, so suddenly there was a big introduction of doimem, of the inanimate, because the structure of the Shiloh was made out of stone, right? But they had curtains over them, and many of those curtains were made out of animal skins once again, so it wasn't all stones, in other words, right? So there were still parts of the animal kingdom within the structure of the Shiloh. When it came to the Beis HaMikdash, it was very different. The Beis HaMikdash had a permanent roof. The whole building was made out of stone. And the roof was made out of wood. In other words, the Beis HaMikdash had no animal skins in its structure. So the animal component was completely gone. The structure was mainly out of doimeh, mainly out of inanimate. A little bit out of wood, which comes to the level of tzameach, right? So it's a kind of downward process. So the Mishkan was made out of much higher forms of existence. Animal kingdom, wood. The whole structure was wood, which is tzameach. A little bit of inanimate. The Mishkan Shiloh had more doimeh, more inanimate, but still had parts of it which were animal skins, come from the animal kingdom. And then all the way down to the Beis HaMikdash, which was only stone and a bit of wood, which is from Tzomech, right? So he says, that's what makes the Beis HaMikdash holier. Because at the end of the day, the whole purpose of the Beis HaMikdash was to bring Hashem's presence down to this physical world. The whole idea of the Beis HaMikdash, right? The whole idea of Karbonis, the whole idea of all of Torah mitzvahs in general, is, as we always say, to make this world a dwelling place for Hashem. In other words, the concept of the chap, the chidush of the Beis HaMikdash, is that we can bring the Shechina, the divine presence, to dwell in a physical home, in a physical place. To bring Hashem, the infinite God, into a finite physical world. Which therefore means that the lower down you bring Hashem's presence into the world, the greater you are fulfilling His mission. Right? And that's why in the Beis HaMikdash, which was specifically made out of lower forms of existence, in other words, you don't even have the animal part there, only mainly made out of inanimate, a little bit of tzameach, that's why the Beis HaMikdash was the holiest of the lot. Because the Beis HaMikdash was the place where finally the purpose and ultimate mission of the world was fulfilled, to bring Hashem down into the lower forms of the physical existence, not just in the physical world, but in the lower forms of the physical world. And that's why it was the holiest thing, and that's why ultimately that was the place which became the permanent resting place for Hashem, and that's why even the actual ground became holy even after the Beis HaMikdash was actually destroyed. Right? And he says, that's why it's Menucha and Nachla. So the Mishkan Shiloh was a great step forward in that regard. It was considered a place of resting. The Shekhinah had some rest there because part of it was inanimate and was already sort of much more permanent. But it doesn't come to the level of Nachla, which is the place of inheritance, which is the ultimate resting place of the Shekhinah, which is in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Temple Mount and Har HaBayis. That's the two things of Mishkan Shiloh. So I just wanted to share that with you because it's a part of the Sukkim which is a little bit sort of unpopular, as I say. Like, it's a bit cryptic and quite complicated, but it's interesting to know how the whole thing actually went and what actually the Torah is talking about when it talks about bringing korbanos to the place where Hashem will choose, and it says you can bring in private altars because you haven't yet arrived in the place of Menucha Nachla. It's not only talking about Beis HaMikdash, because normally when you read the Sukkim, it sounds like it's only talking about the Beis HaMikdash. You know, Hashem will choose a place, Hashem will choose, and so on and so forth. And ultimately, the place of Hashem's choice is the Beis HaMikdash. That's why in the Rambam, the laws of building the Beis HaMikdash are called the Hilchos Beis HaBechira, the place of the chosen house, right, the laws of the chosen house. But nevertheless, the Torah is not only talking about, the Torah is talking about Shiloh and Beis HaMikdash, and that's the Menucha and the Nachla, and it gives a bit of meaning to some of the Pesukim. Okay.